I think it's a much more compelling account of the relationship, which fits much better with the overall facts. Because once the Cold War is over, Arab nationalism is a spent force. Third World Revolution in the Middle East is a spent force. Communism, socialism no longer provide any kind of meaningful threat. And so the idea that you need Israel as some guardian or regional policeman just doesn't really hold up. It's also in that context, remember, in which this is the period in which America has become energy independent. It's no longer dependent on oil from the Middle East. It's also been the era in which they've tried to restrain Iran by integrating it into various agreements, with the partial exception of the Trump administration. And so in that context, it doesn't seem to me that the old justification for the alliance between the West and Israel, which is to say using Israel as a kind of local proxy to batter the forces of Arab nationalism, no longer applies, because Arab nationalism is no longer a meaningful force. So that's the wider context within which my understanding of that relationship operates. And what I think is happening at the moment is this shift. The Israelis' claim to the status of being the ultimate claimants to the identity of victimhood, that's shifting. And it's not surprising that it's happening as the era of unipolarity comes to an end, and that the Palestinians are being slowly eased into that role. And in the context in which I think that the evidence for that is the fact that so many elite figures, including, it seems, many many Jews in Europe and especially in America, seem to be increasingly siding or seeing Palestinian, you know, boosting the claims of the Palestinians, drawing attention to Palestinian suffering and so on, that they are displacing the Israelis' claim to victimhood in that context. Now, the Palestinians' claim to victimhood is going to look very different than the Israeli claim to victimhood in the era of unipolar globalization. But that's roughly the outline of how I understand it.
Hello everyone, welcome back to BungaCast. I'm Alex Hochuli in São Paulo, Brazil, and we are today as well, Philip Cunliffe in Canterbury and George Hoare in London. Hello guys.
Hi.
Hey, we are also the Global Politics Podcast at the end of the end of history.
Mm-hmm. Indeed,
we still are. True.
Still holding on, going strong. We're not going to have any chit-chat because I tried to elicit some chit-chat from these guys at the start and they just blanked it. So just only serious stuff, only getting into the matter at hand, no foreplay whatsoever. It's thrusting into the main content of this episode as well. You get what you get, you know. Anyway, so this is an alpha bonus. We are going to be dealing with your questions and comments that we've received over the past period. But exceptionally, this time we're going to be dedicating a lot of time, almost all of it, to the question of Israel and Palestine and protests around it. This is because, well, one, it's an important issue. Two, it's generated a huge amount of debate on our Patreon and elsewhere. We've received a lot of comments on it, both positive and negative and neutral. And we want to do them justice. So thank you very much for your very serious and engaged comments and criticisms. Well, for most of you anyway, some of you just called us names, but you know, whatever. We're going to deal with them anyway, because that's the kind of robust, spineful people we are. Spineful? We have spine.
Spineful. Yeah. Yeah. We're always getting told how much spine we've got. Too much spine.
I mean, too much spleen maybe as well. So we've kind of tried to group these comments together around different topics. So victimhood, sovereignty and race, the role and effects of protests, populism and the end of history, and the millennial left. So this will all be clear as we go through it. I also think that this should be something that if you happen to not have listened to that episode that we did a month ago or so, that you should be able to follow this, because actually it's a discussion about Israel and Palestine and about protests around it and how to respond to it. So I think that stands on it, it'll be able to stand on its own 2 feet, or it should do anyway. So thank you for all the positive comments that we received. A lot of these in private. This sounds like one of those things like, yeah, no, but I've got loads of friends, mate. I've got loads of, you know, whatever. But people highlighting the fact that the type of discussion we had on here is something that you don't get elsewhere, both in terms of perspective and approach. And so people were very appreciative of it. One listener, David Turner, emailed in to say, I've been an on and off listener of the Bunga Cast and also enjoyed your appearances on other programs. I mostly wanted to email because I really enjoyed y'all's latest episode on the campus protests, which living in NYC, I've found vexing from a tactical perspective of despising the left's love of quote unquote holding space, but also horrified by seeing hundreds of cops used at the whim of failed university leaders. So I found y'all's show extremely nuanced and considered in a way that feels lacking in their coverage. Thank you, David. Now, Eli S., a comment on, a comment on the protests themselves and the universities. These universities marketed themselves as the quote-unquote front of house to customers, that is, applicants and their families. This means the university is presented as a center for activism and, you know, implicitly liberal left or radical liberal activism. The students admitted under the premise of being activists are now barging into the quote unquote back of house and demanding that how the kitchen operates should fit the dining room's progressive vibe. This is utterly insubordinate and unallowable by any reasonable business operation. This is a point which was made in similar terms by Musa Al-Gharbi in Compact in an excellent essay, but that these elite universities sell themselves quite explicitly as being a place where you can come and practice politics, you can hone your activism chops. And of course, the students are just going ahead and doing that. And of course, they've taken it too far, hence the repression. Now, there's a big question around victimhood, and we're going to try to explain this out. I'm going to run through a couple of comments and then George and Phil jump in, though, of course, feel free to jump in as I go through as well. Matthew Hollingshead said, this is retarded. More specifically, it's just flat idealism. How does a realist or a Marxist look at the geopolitics of the Middle East and the simultaneous necessity of the pivot to Asia for U.S. hegemony and say, actually, the problem is the ideology of victimhood? The very simple demand for a regional satrap is surely a more coherent reason to spend $2 billion in one night. We're going to try to parse that out in a bit, but just to gesture towards a point that is being kind of poked at here is how can this idea of victimhood, which is like a kind of culture wars, identity politics thing, have anything to do with these big matters of international politics? So we're going to try to talk through that mediation, or indeed maybe dismiss it. So moving on, Saudi, SeaWorld or bust. Phil seems to be taking some heat both on here and on Twitter for his take that the significance of the Israel-Palestine conflict in Western popular conscience is related to the need to define victimhood as opposed to more concrete geopolitical concerns. It's perhaps phrased a bit artlessly, but as someone who's often critical of Phil's takes, I actually think it's one of the more interesting arguments I've seen on the topic. I think his argument needs to be understood in the context of his wider writings on international relations, which after all is his field, concerning the ways in which liberal interventionism is justified on the basis of victimhood. My impression of this argument has always been that it's somewhat idealist to ascribe any kind of significant causal role to what strikes me as a largely post hoc ideological construction, that is to say, victimhood. In this case, however, given that we're talking about the conflict's place in the collective conscience rather than the concrete causes of the conflict itself, a bit of idealism feels appropriate, especially given how hand-wavy the other explanations offered all seem. Can anyone actually tell me what this geopolitical struggle is that Israel's meant to be so vital to? It seems that there's a pretty strong case to be made that America's ties to Israel are actually more of a liability than an asset in strictly realpolitik terms. Any response on that quickly, or I'll move on to the next one?
No, I think we can move on because I think it's useful to put all of these comments on a similar theme together because I think some of them develop on each other. So it's useful, I think, to have it all out.
Okay. Andrew Mountford says, the ethereal debate about victimhood misses the obvious reality that free speech on this issue is being curtailed because it's in the interest of the UK, US, Israeli military industrial complex and foreign policy establishment. Some quote-unquote vulgar Marxism is needed. It's also strange, particularly given you've had Norman Finkelstein on, that you don't acknowledge that attempts to conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism have been quite clear over the last 30 years in particular, and reached a pretty intense level in the Labour Party over the International Human Rights Association definition of anti-Semitism. This policy serves the military-industrial complex as well as Zionists who want to reinforce an identity with Israel as the quote-unquote mainstream Judaism, as well as other political ends regarding attacking the anti-imperialist left. And then there was some debate that ensued about making comparison with Brexit. We're going to come on to that in a little bit, where there's some comparisons between populism and these protests, which will be interesting to explore. But firstly, on victimhood, Phil, why don't you go ahead?
Right.
So the victim of criticism speaks.
No, I won't take the victim label at this here. So I perhaps should, the easiest way perhaps to respond to some of these criticisms is to explain out what I had in mind by talking about Israel's role with respect to victimhood and why that's important with what's happening to the with the protests at the moment. My view on this is that it's people have accused it of being idealist, which I suppose means that it's not rooted in something deeper and more profound about the structure of world politics or international order or the global political economy. But I want to broaden out the picture and explain what I think the relationship is. So the broader context within which for the last 20 or 30 years or so has been that of unipolarity, which is to say overwhelming US dominance of the international system. And Yanis Varoufakis, for all of his sins, he came up with the idea of the Minotaur structure of the world order, in which he has along the lines of the Greek myth, whereby you have the Minotaur, America, at the center of the labyrinth, to whom the rest of the international, other states in the international order must pay tribute. They're sacrificed to the Minotaur in return for it providing security. So the classic model would be, say, Germany and Japan and China and so on buying U.S. treasuries and accepting U.S. leadership of the international system during the era of unipolarity. In the era of unipolarity, then, you have that the basis of the US's global dominance is that it has the right and the claim and the authority to intervene anywhere in the world, and that it has that discretion and basis and power to do that, not only military power, but also ideological claim and political and legal authority. And the basis, one of the most powerful bases for that, is the idea of victimhood. The idea of human rights suffering. And so this corresponds with the era in which the left retreated from ideas of national liberation and broader ideas of emancipation and independent nationhood and accepted the idea of humanitarian or improvement to relieving the relief of humanitarian suffering and more restrained models of what political action and development was capable of. And so the two things mesh together very well. So in that context, if victimhood provides, under the conditions of unipolarity, unipolar globalization, victimhood provides an excellent license for the American policeman to intervene anywhere in the international order at all. If you're going to maintain that claim, then you have to support the victim state, which is Israel, right? So Israel explicitly, since I've made the claim before on the pod, since the Eichmann trial, Israel has explicitly cultivated its identity as the victim state. And this involved the transformation, I think, also in the self-understanding of Zionism in the post-war period, but that's a separate debate. So the point is, if you want to maintain your claim to intervene on the basis of victimhood anywhere in a unipolar world order, you have to be seen to be supporting those who claim the ultimate victim status, which is the Jews in the aftermath of the Holocaust and defending their rights in the Jewish state. So the idea of America's relationship to Israel on the basis of victimhood is claimed in a broader geopolitical and international context. And that, I think, is a much more, I think it's a much more compelling account of the relationship, which fits much better with the overall facts, because once the Cold War is over, Arab nationalism is a spent force. Third World Revolution in the Middle East is a spent force. communism, socialism no longer provide any kind of meaningful threat. And so the idea that you need Israel as some guardian or regional policeman just doesn't really hold up. It's also in that context, remember, in which this is the period in which America has become energy independent. It's no longer dependent on oil from the Middle East. It's also been the era in which they've tried to restrain Iran by integrating it into various agreements, with the partial exception of the Trump administration. And so in that context, it doesn't seem to me that the old justification for the alliance between the West and Israel, which is to say using Israel as a kind of local proxy to batter the forces of Arab nationalism, no longer applies, because Arab nationalism is no longer a meaningful force. So that's the wider context within which my understanding of that relationship operates. And what I think is happening at the moment is this shift that gradually the Israelis claim to the status of being the ultimate claimants to the identity of victimhood, that's shifting. And it's not surprising that it's happening as the era of unipolarity comes to an end, and that the Palestinians are being slowly eased into that role. And in the context in which I think that the evidence for that is the fact that so many elite figures, including, it seems, many Jews in Europe and especially in America, seem to be increasingly siding or seeing Palestinian, you know, boosting the claims of the Palestinians, drawing attention to Palestinian suffering and so on, that they are displacing the Israelis' claim to victimhood in that context. Now, the Palestinians' claim to victimhood is going to look very different than the Israeli claim to victimhood in the era of unipolar globalization. But that's roughly the outline of how I understand it. And hopefully that answers these criticisms that this is some kind of empty abstraction or some kind of idealist construct that doesn't take sufficient cognizance of the underlying relationships of power. But this idea that Israel is a regional satrap, how you have to presuppose there's something in the Middle East that needs to be suppressed or contained, and that doesn't seem to me to be the case in the aftermath of the Cold War.
George? Yeah, I don't have quite such an extensive answer to this. I think, though, there's a good piece in Matthew Crawford's Substack, which we'll link to, on the victimological imagination. So I guess I was kind of approaching some of these criticisms from a slightly different direction from Phil, which was, you know, talking or thinking a little more, or they made me think more about the relationship between, I guess, the role of the victim within contemporary American politics and international relations. So not that kind of geopolitical context, but more how, you know, if it is the case that we have this kind of triumph of American idealism or the exporting of American kind of modes of politics, then, you know, what is the, is this a new transition within American domestic politics, or is it something which is a little bit older? And this, you know, this essay basically argues that that I referred to, the victimological imagination, that it's been the last kind of 50 years where you've really seen a shifting of the domestic state's basis of legitimacy to it towards its protection of the vulnerable. And there's, you know, referred to Pete Ramsey's essay on the ideology of vulnerability many times on this podcast, but it's still very much worth a read. Yeah, so it does, I guess, what's my kind of answer to these criticisms? It seems like it is, to the extent that international relations can be explained at least in part by domestic class politics, which I think must be the case, and to at least a certain extent, then the role of the victim is an important one in domestic, contemporary domestic American politics. It does seem to me, I think, you know, Phil's points in when we recorded this episode were very well made, that this is part of the basis of the contemporary state's legitimacy. There aren't any other sources. Representation is not there. So it has to be something which is not kind of democratic political, but is instead another kind of basis of legitimacy. So I guess I would support Phil's against, you know, got to back up the Bunga boys against this criticism by saying that, yeah, there is another model here which seems also to fit, which is that there is that kind of projection or that kind of exporting of American domestic politics throughout the whole of the world. And we can't, you know, we can't be fully kind of immune from that.
So I think I would agree. Sorry, Alex, just quickly to to reinforce or underscore what George was saying. I mean, I would agree with that. And I think so if people are looking for an understanding that is, I suppose, that runs deeper, I think, you know, the international in an era in which you have the relationship between state and society has been restructured, and so that the state relates to society in the sense of treating everyone as if they're in potentially the basis of its authority is on protecting you from each other, and everyone is fragmented into vulnerable, mutually hostile, suspicious communities, you know, which is the era of globalization, right? Because you have, on the one hand, you have kind of all these various disconnected cultural communities. And on the other hand, you have these kind of tremendously powerful transnational corporations and the states that service to their needs and defend their interests. And that's the basis on which the state relates to its domestic population. So in that larger context, the foreign policy and the international relations in that era is also going to be very strongly based. Is going to be very strongly based on the claims that are associated with victimhood. And so it seems to me to be that Israel in particular occupied a very important place in that wider political context in the last 30 years or so. And that status that's now being contested, and that is the basis of the intensity with which it's being felt. But if you're looking for, you know, if you're looking for a kind of materialist explanation, which is like, oh, it's something to do with energy prices, or you know, it's because the Houthis pose such a terrible threat to international order, or Hezbollah is going to take over the Middle East, or something. You know, I mean, those are has very little bearing, if any, on the broader question. The pivot
maybe Matthew
to Asia,
Holley's head is desiring that Hezbollah is capable of taking over, and that's why he thinks that the US stands so staunchly behind Israel.
I think the Americans are trying to disentangle themselves from the Middle East, and they've, you know, always struggled to disentangle themselves from the Middle East ever since the late 1970s, if not before. But nonetheless, that's what they're trying to do. That was the purpose of the nuclear deal with Iran. That was the purpose of devolving the insane war in Yemen to the Saudis. That is the purpose of the Abraham Accords, trying to establish a normalization between the Arab states and Israel. And the main axis of confrontation is between the Gulf monarchies and Israel on one side, as against Iran and its allies in the region. That's the main basis of the confrontation, which the Americans don't, you know, Israel is only one part of that larger structure. But like I say, the key relationship is the one based on victimhood. And that is the claim which Israel is, it's losing that status, I think.
So I think there's something interesting here. I mean, I have kind of three actually closely related points. The first relates to the US's interests. I think this will be viewed in retrospect as obviously a misstep and a weakness on the part of the Biden administration, because even in terms of its own self-interest, this would have been a moment to put the brakes a little on Israel in a more forthright manner and extricate itself perhaps from the full consequences of that very tight relationship. I wonder, I mean, this is speculative on my part, but whether there isn't some relation between US gerontocracy and a misreading of the situation, because for the generation of a Biden, you have a very tight US-Israeli relationship. You have American Jews entirely identified with Israel and it and the perpetuation of Israel's existence. And Biden just kind of went, well, we're going to stick to the plan as he saw it, as he kind of grown up and his whole political career has been premised, at least in international relations, on sustaining that tight relationship between the US and Israel. And he's actually misread the moment.
Or maybe he thinks it's still like 1980 something.
Well, but that's kind of what I mean. Yeah. You know,
I
don't know, but his team is all Obama-nauts, right? They're people who grew up watching The West Wing, famously. It's not the wider administration doesn't seem to be gerontocratic.
But even that's an old world, right?
But it's not gerontocratic, right?
Okay. Point taken. Anyway, the second point I wanted to make relates to Israel, because although Phil's right that the role that victimhood has played in Israeli construction and self-image and the projection of and justification of itself in the international arena is very important, I think there's an ambivalence there, or even something which is a genuine contradiction within the idea of the Israeli nation, which is that Israel was also premised on the idea, the creation of the state of Israel and the maintenance of it and the defense of it, as the Jew no longer being victim. The Jew is the victim is the place, has his place in the shtetl or in the ghetto, and being a sabra, a prickly pear, born in the desert, fortified, etc., is no longer a victim. He's just one who, or she indeed, is one who is forthrightly pursues her own self-interest, and in defense of its own interests and its perpetuation of its identity against enemies, and doesn't care what anybody has to say about that. So there's a real kind of ambivalence and even contradiction between that and the victimhood. And I'm not proposing to kind of resolve that. I'm just saying that these things kind of coexist. And even defenders of Israel now make that argument that we need to defend Israel because Israel itself is a state which defends itself and doesn't, you know, has a unique historical role and needs to perpetuate that and shouldn't care what other people think. But of course, you know,
it's a license based on victimhood. I mean, well, in that claim.
Exactly. Exactly. So anyway, I think there's an interesting ambivalence there.
No, which is really important because, you know, there were there were riots in Israel, I think, certainly significant protests when the Ben-Gurion government decided to accept reparations from West Germany, as it was at the time, during the Cold War. You know, the idea that that Israel would take reparations from Germany for the crimes committed by the German state against Jews, it was seen as anathema, you know, and that's, I think, that idea of opposing reparations, you know, the reason the Ben-Gurion government took the reparations under duress, because it was important to the Americans to rehabilitate West Germany as part of building up the Western Bloc in the Cold War and strengthening NATO and so on. But the idea of opposing, you know, kind of it's so alien to our contemporary feeling and understanding of politics now, the idea that people would push back against reparations, and that reparations would be kind of have to be forced onto the people who don't want to accept them, you know, that's entirely alien to our contemporary politics.
Indeed. To reject the role of supplicant as being humiliating is like, whoa, really? So closely related to that, a question about self-interest, and particularly with relation to the left in the West, I think a lot of the protest around this presents itself as having had a bit of interpretation here. It's not literally what is claimed, but the protesters, the left as a whole, pretends that the scale has fallen from its eyes. It is no longer stuck in the post-political humanitarian mode. Here on this issue, it is forthrightly behind Palestine, Palestinian liberation, Palestinian self-determination. And it is just fighting that cause. And it isn't interested in the niceties of matters or purely humanitarian concerns. I think that's the kind of presentation that comes across. And indeed, even some of the responses that we've received, that is an idea which is communicated. And There's a kind of self-deception going on there, because the reality is that victimhood and associated notions of humanitarianism and so on are still actually quite fundamental, and just pure self-interest. I mean, pure self-interest, of course, that's question begging. But, you know, the notion of pursuing national self-interest, for example, is still somewhat taboo. So, yes, you might say, actually, I don't care about offending, you know, Zionist cry bullies. I'm going to say, fuck Israel, support Palestine, right? And that is an expression of, you know, kind of politics based on interest, politics based on strength and kind of...
It sounds like a politics based on virtue signaling.
Well, but this is what I'm getting at, right? So I think the idea is that, you know, this... the fighting for Palestine is something which is kind of nothing to do with the humanitarian stuff. But the only reason that there's interest in Palestine and why Palestine is kind of a worthy cause is the whole premise of it is victimhood. It's the fact that the Palestinians are being victimized. I mean, that's a genuine thing that's happening. It's not just a projection. But that is what makes the Palestinians a worthy subject. It's not an adherence, except in perhaps rare cases, and I think this is completely illusory, that Palestine represents some different vision of society, right? Or some kind of wider goal, because that isn't the case, right? To the extent mm-hmm. that it did as part of an anti-imperialist struggle, even there it's questionable. You know, it wasn't like the free Palestine was utopia. It was just the question of defending self-determination. That is certainly not the case today. And no one, I don't think, can conceive of a good argument for why you would be pro-Palestine, right? What you are is against the brutalization of the Palestinians and perhaps in defense of their right for self-determination, despite the facts on the ground, which there, as we've discussed, there is nothing that is pushing to create a secular national state in Palestine at the moment, right?
My point
is just to round it off is that there's a victimhood which underlies all this politics, a kind of conception of victimhood, and the victim makes you the good guy and the guy that you need to back, which underlies all this politics, even if it's obscured by layers of, you know, kind of radical rabble-rousing rhetoric.
Yeah, I still think that Alex Gurevich's piece that he wrote, I can't remember exactly when, but published in Damage, and we talked it through with him on the pod, is still perhaps the best thing that I've read on this. And it just, what you were saying there, Alex, made me think of other Alex's point that there's no, like, what sort of political subject essentially is being constructed or supported here? Like, previously you would have supported perhaps a liberation movement because it had a chance of winning, very small sort of chance. But I guess if you're talking about what is the kind of victim subject of politics, in some ways that's a subject that most completely performs its role as a victim if it's unable to get out of that victim position. So in some ways it's sort of a self-reproduction of this situation. And that is, I think, essentially what Alex Gurevich's argument was at that point. I think it's still true now that, you know, there is no political, like the violence has no potential political solution, i.e. there is no force capable of kind of constituting a new Palestinian state, because, well, except for Hamas, but I don't think there are that many defenders of Hamas amongst Bunkercast listeners. I'd be surprised to hear if there are any. So yeah, that's a half-formed thought, but it just, what you were saying made me think that there is a, like, if you have the politics of where a victim is central to legitimation, then there is also a changed definition of what political action is or could be. And it's not about, you know, success is not a new Palestinian state, it's a reproduction of victim status, which might make me sound very callous, and I don't mean to be, but I think that's sort of almost what's entailed by that kind of shift to a fully kind of victimological politics of legitimation, which, you know, is kind of a sad dead end, because it is a reproduction of this situation. There is no it kind of, you know, functions quote unquote best when it does reproduce that status.
If the left wasn't pretending to do anything other than just defend the victim, in this case, the very obvious victim that is like a bunch of innocent Palestinians being murdered and displaced, then I think there would be less to talk about. But I think there's a lot of pretenses at doing something else politically. But
I'm not sure there's that many pretenses. I think it's fairly, you know, I think it's clear that what motivates people is protesting at Palestinian suffering and the desire to restrain the brutality of the Israeli response. You know, I mean,
so the protests are good then. That's a noble cause.
Well, I mean, from the humanitarian viewpoint, yes, but, you know, we can. I think we can move on anyway, because we're coming to this.
Yeah, exactly. So, on to broadly what we've kind of characterized here is the aim of the protest, strategy, tactics, and so on. Marc Larrivée says, I'm aligned with your view on the protests and the Palestinian situation. Yet I think the left must stake out an anti-imperialist position, even if in the short term it's only a call for a ceasefire for the US to end aid and security. As minimalist as that is, it is superior to a realist position that relinquishes the upper hand to Israel. Maybe somewhat relatedly, Benjamin Fong, guest editor of magazine, friend of the podcast, etc., says, I think it's pretty tough to make a serious criticism of the left based on the protests and responses to the war slash massacre. And this is not because you're missing the bigger picture, but because I think there's no coherent mark for the criticism to hit. Has some organized group put forward the demand for ceasing aid or stipulations on aid to Israel? Of course. Does that mean that demand is going to show up more than ceasefire signs on protests? Of course not. And that is because it is collections of individuals showing up out of a perfectly justified, if ultimately impotent, moral outrage. The US left failed to gain any power to assert leverage over the present situation, and criticism is probably deserved there. But it's for that reason that the symptomatic reason, cover for a new quietism or whatever, has no true object, or it is only true for certain groups of Twitter personalities. So the idea here basically being that there's nothing there to criticize. It's just a random collection of individuals protesting in moral outrage. There isn't an organization that is there that is making a strategic statement in relation to real politics. It's also worth noting that opposition to Israel's actions is a broadly majoritarian position in the US. This is opposed to the Vietnam War protests, which started at a time when most Americans still supported the war. The question, as always, is whether certain tactics or rhetoric are actually helping or hurting the cause. But this, again, is a function of having no representative organization or set of organizations to discipline actions and messaging. In any event, I'm hard-pressed to single this issue out as indicative of the left's failings, given the wide range of strange and fringe views that are often hold currency in left media outlets. Maybe we should deal with this. Oh, there's one more point, actually, on this. Jacob Bucci says that protesters should demand congressional authorization of military force is a West Wing-ass take. The Congress that fully supports the war, or the Congress that Biden has circumvented with thousands of tiny arms deals? Protesters have been very clear that their material demand is disclosure and divestment. There's no pretense that they can end it, end the war, only that they can absolve themselves of funding it with their tuition dollars. I mean, just very quickly on Jacob Bucci's last point there, as Musa Al-Gharbi pointed out in his essay very correctly, those universities are not funding, their tuition, kids' tuition paid for them by themselves, by loans, by their parents, is not funding Israel. In fact, it is the endowments which fund their study, and the tuition is just a small contribution to it. So it gets the relationship of funding the wrong way around. Right, on to the other points, guys.
Well, yeah, just on Jacob Bucci's point, because I think it was directed at me, and I take the hit of the insult of making a West Wing arse take, which I think is a good one, but I don't agree with the premise. I think it's the wrong way around. Introducing the people, democratic control into foreign policy decision making is the opposite of a kind of wonkish workaround that Josh Lyman or I'm trying to think of the other I was going to say Captain Bartlett, President Bartlett, would have put into play. And I think this is, not to belabor the point, but we saying that we want to control our military is very different to saying it's not our military. It's not, we don't want to fund it, not in our name. And it is the former, not the latter, because the self-exculpation and distancing is not the same thing as saying, the military is an expression of our country and we want to democratically control what it does. And that's, obviously it's not something which you just demand one time and then it's like, yeah, that changes. But that has to be the ultimate kind of aim or demand. Otherwise it's just going to be as I said, almost a withdrawal and a kind of distancing of away from the actions of the military, which in fact will make things worse in the longer term.
So I want to build on what George said. I mean, it's true, we kind of expecting that kind of demand of these protests would expect a tremendous kind of a far more political articulation than might be reasonable. But what we were trying to get at was the fact that these protests aren't really articulated in such a way that they're made to the interests of fellow citizens as members of the US as a political community, right? I think that is, how do you make the case? If you want to make the case that supporting Israel is not in the national interest of the UK or the US, you know, by all means, right? I mean, I think that's what we were trying to get at with this, which is, if it framed in that way, it's a very different kind of argument. Say, the protest that I passed on UCL campus where I work was, you know, Yemen, Yemen, make us proud, turn another ship around, in reference to the Houthis sending out rockets and to the shipping in the Red Sea, right? Which has been defended on the grounds that the Houthis are simply upholding international law. So I think, I mean, you know, that's what we're trying to get at, perhaps inadequately. So Jacob is, you know, lands his blow with the fact that it's a West Wing Gas take. But I, like George, I would stick to the broader point about the framing of the criticism and the demand that's being made. As regards the divestment demand put on the academic institutions of which the students are part, it's totally obnoxious. Quite apart from the fact of the point that was made in the Compact magazine essay about the fact that American institutions are effectively self-funding through their endowments, the idea that universities should cease having any engagement with Israeli universities, refuse to host Israeli academics, refuse to have any intellectual or academic linkages with Israeli public institutions, bodies, or Israeli universities, is, you know, I think it's not only obnoxious in every sense of the word, but also entirely wrong-headed.
And self-defeating.
Well, that's what I mean, right? All it does effectively is it boosts the claim of the Netanyahu government and his supporters and far-right Israeli politicians, that drives everybody into the same corner. As well as presuming, of course, that all Israelis are in the same boat simply by virtue of being Jewish or Israeli. So the divestment, the idea of that Western universities should break links with Israel on the say-so of the protesters, and that would be positive, is not only noxious, but also, I mean, totally stupid, and indicates just how much that demand is bound up with virtue signaling.
In fairness, I think the demand is for divestment in Israeli arms. I mean, no doubt that there is also a lot of BDS.
No, but it's always comes well with the institutional rupture, right? So it's not kind of, you know, I mean, how many do you think Oxford University funds the Israeli armaments industry? It doesn't, right? So, but, you know, even accepting that, it's always bound up with also breaking academic linkages, breaking institutional linkages, a complete isolation of Israel as a country, which is to say Israeli civil society, as well as the Israeli state.
I agree with that. Yeah, absolutely.
Just another couple of, because I guess that was mostly on Jacob Bucci's point. One thing that Mark Larive put that I would, maybe I'm making too much of this, but this kind of anti-imperialist position, that doesn't strike me as actually the right one. Instead, it should be pro-democracy. I mean, I sound like probably a bit of a broken record, but like,
that's a West Wing-ass take, George.
I know. I'm going to, this is going to haunt me and follow me around every time I try and make a subtle distinction or say something, you know, big brained, I'm just going to get that thrown back in my face. But yeah, I mean, you want control of foreign policy, not to determine the direction of it, if that makes sense, or not to say it has to go in this direction. Anti-imperialism is like you be against that imperialist force, but saying we want control of foreign policy means we get to decide it ultimately in our national interest, which would be anti-imperialist. But I feel like it's a shortcut, and it's a kind of a phrase that sort of makes it too easy and makes it too kind of, I don't know, like, you know, it's already bound up what you need to do, rather than trying to take that responsibility on yourself as a citizen. I don't know, might be making too much of that. But on Ben's point, I think it's a good one, or more that one thing I would really agree with is that I don't, and you two, I might disagree with the two of you on this, or maybe with Phil, that I don't think this is the left's worst failing in the past decade. I think it's, you know, maybe top three, but it's certainly no Brexit, and even more than that, certainly no COVID. Like, I think this is, maybe it's just that I've, you know, the scales have fallen from my eyes and I'm now a realist or a cynic or whatever. And I know the way things really work in the world. But I would, you know, I would like to think that this is, there have been worse errors. And I think COVID is one that I think is almost forgotten now, like all of that support for lockdowns. And I know we've talked about this endlessly and apologies for bringing this back up again, but I think it is important to bring it back up again, because that was more of a, like that was at home. You could see directly, instantly the impacts of that. And so I feel like, you know, not that this is our tribunal holding the left, whatever that is, to account. But I think I would agree with that sentiment of Ben's.
No, I agree. I mean, I don't think this is the worst thing the left has done or something like that at all. I mean, I
don't know where that came from at all, George.
Yeah. The point, though,
so Ben, I'm hard pressed to single this issue out as indicative of the left's failings. You know, it's not the...
Oh, right. But you're talking about Ben Farr. I mean, yeah, I don't think either Alex or I have made the claim.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So, I mean, responding directly to Ben Fong's point, I think on the one level, this is the nature of politics today. There is actually no left, right? I mean, there's no left in the sense that there's no organizations or hardly any kind of self-constituted left-wing organizations to which have some role, some weight, maybe some leverage, maybe some power, and who can make strategic decisions and make calls for things and whose decisions matter. I mean, that is just not the case. It's completely withered. I mean, we don't need to rehearse this discussion. But the point is that in a kind of real material sense, other than maybe as a set of ideas or inclinations or voting behaviors, there is no left. So in that regard, you know, you can maybe... And I think any argument which would try to prove that there was would be the exception that proves rule. It'd be saying, oh, well, look, there's some people in DSA or whatever. You know, I mean, it's nothing. So it's true that when we're criticizing, you know, the protests or whatever, and you say, and you talk about the left, you are talking about something kind of ethereal. You know, you're criticizing what is kind of an inclination shared amongst some not really affiliated group of people.
I don't agree with that. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think, that's too easy. That's too like, oh, it's an inclination shared. It's a, you know, it doesn't exist. It does exist. There's a class basis.
What are the organizations like as a self-conscious agency, right? Not just as like something which connects these people or something like that.
Well,
in a genuine sense of left, I mean, of a socialist left,
it seems to me the problem with Ben Fong's point is, you know, he seems to say that it's unfair to put all this on this kind of very disorganized, inarticulate, deracinated, grab bag of aims and demands, and that, and that seems to me to give too much of a pass.
Well, can I finish my point? Because I wasn't, my intention wasn't to give a pass. It was discussing and setting up the point that I was going to make. In this situation of there is no politics today, you know, because compared to the past, there is no politics today. There aren't organizations. There's no civil, civil society's withered, atomized, all the rest of it. We know that. So we can't do politics. I mean, we make criticism here pretending as if there is politics, right? But the reality is that there isn't, and that there aren't organizations to which you can say, well, you know, the Communist Party acted in such a way. This Trotskyist group responded. The Labour Party responded in this way. You know, these things just don't exist, right? And so in that situation, you're forced to kind of act as if there is politics and criticize nevertheless. Now, you can do that in two ways, I think. You can either treat it imminently, you critique it imminently and basically say, look, I'm on the same side as these protesters, broadly speaking, but I think they should pursue their politics in a different way so as to be effective because we have some vaguely shared goals of socialism or whatever. Or you treat it symptomatically. Right, which I think has been our approach, and you say, well, look, what is this ethereal, group of individuals who don't really have any connection who turn up to protest and hold up signs and whatever? What do they represent? What are they symptoms of? And I think we do that because I think as a way of trying to understand our historical moment. And I think that's still legitimate, even if there aren't organizations which you can point to who have programmatic statements.
Well, so, I mean, I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, Alex, but I mean, there are organizations you can point to who have, you know, programmatic statements, not least, you know, small communist groupuscules and Trotskyists and...
No, sure, but
but, you know, the Trotskyists were always kind of insignificant kind of fringe groups. So I suppose my point is that, you know, there is the reason... This, I think, cuts more directly to Ben Fong's point. So it's true that if you look at the opinion polls, the majority of people in the U.S. are sympathetic. You know, they feel that there should be a ceasefire. They would like the conflict to end, and there is more sympathy for the Palestinians than there has been in the past. But that doesn't make it so. There's kind of a belief or a basis of support for an end to the conflict, but it's not the uppermost or most important thing for Americans, which is overwhelmingly domestic factors connected to the economy and the presidential elections, right? So that, I think, is, you know, that is the broader context. And within that, then you have this highly elite campus-based protest, which is, and I think importantly, it's signaling a changing of perspectives among the elite with respect to Israel and a shift of sympathy towards the Palestinians. And some of that is cracking through in the policies of the Biden administration, but I think it's more a generational shift. And so we'll see the long-term consequences of that turn over the next 30 years or so. But I just want to reiterate what I said before with regards to the point. You know, I don't think that the fact that it's inarticulate means that they get a pass, or that expecting more kind of expression of political sentiment is something which is unfair to expect. Because if the overwhelming sentiment that binds together the protesters is essentially humanitarian and doesn't connect to any possibility for politically improving the situation between Israel and Palestine, or points to some attempt to resolve the conflict or exit the quagmire of conflict, then it seems to me it's legitimate to make that case. So, and that is, in fact, you know, what's happening. And that is the claim, you know, this is where I support and agree with Alex Gorovich's Peace and Damage, where he drew attention to this. None of the violence that's being used or the politics that's currently on offer offers any exit from the conflict. And the humanitarian attempts to address the conflict mean that it will only perpetuate violence. So no matter how well-meaning or well-motivated many of the protesters might be, because there is no political resolution to the conflict except in greater involvement of the international community, greater imposing itself on Israel, restraining Israel, a humanitarian intervention, essentially, there is no possibility of actually ending the conflict.
So to move on to another theme, relatedly, cynicism. Someone who has an obnoxious name, which is, I wonder how long you can make a name on Patreon, blah, 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 blah. It's a whole long sentence. It's very clever. They chastise what they call our cynicism over the protests, for them not being fully formed. Even Phil, this person even calls Phil the Sultan of Cynicism, which I think is a good title. I'm going to adopt that. Thanks. I wonder how long you can make a name on Patreon. Anyway, they continue by saying, perhaps these protests are to that sort of democratic control over foreign policy what bread riots are to democratic control over the economy. That is to say, that they're the germ. The immediate aim is to stop the killing. A developed movement would then, out of that demand, start exploring how more systemic changes could be made. But the cart isn't going to come before the horse. Now, Will M. Hall, and this I think was on Instagram, exceptionally on this episode, drawing some comments from that we've received elsewhere, so it's not just the Patreon stuff, but some stuff from email and some few things from social media, which are inevitably the angriest and most shouty of the answer. I don't think that's by accident. So anyway, Will Emmahall says, this podcast used to be interesting and make sharp, incisive points about the liberal political class. The desperate need to have a wild, previously unvoiced take seems to have just descended the podcast into relentless anti-left sentiment and contrarianism. The guys on the pod aren't actually involved with organizing or any real form of politics. They're totally detached critics, buried under endless levels of irony and cynicism. It's effectively just reactionary garbage at this point. Cheers, Will. Guys, responses.
Well, I don't want to talk about George's embarrassing period of activism, so maybe he can talk about that himself. But just on the point about this, for whatever it's worth, you know, I've been my political organizing or activity, you know, is involved in campaigning over Brexit, particularly in the aftermath of the vote, in the pushback against the second referendum. I was vice president of the union branch when I was at the University of Kent, and then union activist for quite a while, including heading up the union, the branch of the union within my own department, on and off over the period that I was there, and was frequently.
Can you talk us through some of your key achievements in that? In that period, what was the context? What actions did you take, and how did you evaluate those actions?
The achievements. No. What I was trying to do with the union organizing—that was all.
No, I'm being facetious, and I think.
Let me answer facetious. Well, it's not facetiously, but I'm going to take the opportunity to answer your question, George, which is that the labor organizing, or the union organizing, I should say, on campus was shot to pieces by lockdown. But that aside, you know, for whatever it's worth. And Alex and George can talk about it. I don't think, you know, it's simply not true. For better or for worse, I mean, we've been involved, all of us have been involved in different, in political activity at different points. I've not been involved in the Democratic Party or a Democratic Party adjacent organization, which I think is what counts as organizing for most of the left. And so I've got no problem with not having done that, or putting my hopes in kind of trying to pull a major social democratic party further to the left. So if that's the only thing that counts as organizing, then guilty as charged.
So I just quickly on this, the point about cynicism, I think it's interesting that people, I don't know if I've said this before, or if we've said this before, but I think it is telling that people who've been with us for a long time as listeners, and who have been enthusiastic or generally accepting of points that we've made on topics which are, you know, controversial on the left, and which we've been, I guess, heterodox with regard to whatever counts as left orthodoxy today. So whether it's, you know, leaving the European Union or COVID or identity politics or various other matters, that on Palestine, we've seen to have overstepped the mark, and that people are not willing to give us the benefit of the doubt as being honest or at least somehow genuinely motivated critics of what is going on the left. And I think that is interesting. And of course, those critics would respond that it's because we've gone too far. We've jumped the shark somehow.
Yeah, too far from what? I mean, that's the question, right? Because I mean, we don't pursue this for the pleasure of being abused or getting kind of insults or
we did do an episode on Israel and Palestine like forever. You know, we did 6.5 years of the podcast without ever touching on it, because we were like, that was a kind of an editorial decision that wasn't a big thing to be talked about. We think that it gets talked about too much, so we were like, let's not do that. So it's not like we've been itching to get in and provoke people by having contrarian takes on Israel and Palestine for ages, and now we finally have. You know, it's very much the opposite.
Yeah, yeah. And I should say, I mean, it's with regret. I mean, I suppose regret isn't the right word, but with, I suppose, you know, it's something which is frustrating for me. My sympathy for the Palestinians was something which was almost pre-political for me. It's something because growing up in the Middle East, going to school in the Middle East and having plenty of Arab friends in school and classmates and so on, obviously my sympathies were with the Palestinians before I really became even kind of politically conscious or aware. We learned about the Israel-Palestine conflict in class, had friends from Lebanon and Syria, Palestinian friends as well, Palestinian schoolmates. And so, you know, it's something which is, it's a position, my own position has kind of evolved, but it's, you know, my kind of immediate instincts have always been very sympathetic to the Palestinians, but that's not the, you know, that's not taking a considered political view on the matter. With respect to this point about maybe it's the germ of something larger, I suppose we'll see, right? It doesn't seem to me that it will be, because there doesn't seem to me the germ of a meaningful political solution. All it seems to me is that there'll be more, that it will boost the authority of the West to claim humanitarian right to oversee and regulate conflict in the Middle East. That's all that the protests seem to me to be effecting. And that the Colombia protesters, you know, the people who will go on to run the State Department, that they'll be more sympathetic to the Palestinians in the future than to the Israelis, and that the Palestinians will kind of occupy the status of a favored victim and the basis of authority for the Americans to intervene in the Middle East. That seems to me the germ of what's happening. Right?
I suspect the our predictions will be wrong on this, just because the conflict in the Middle East has such a symbolic weight that so much of kind of what seemed to be the coming politics in terms of kind of national conservatism or whatever is so closely aligned, and particularly the far right in many different parts of the world who have adopted Israel as its cause, that this will no doubt transmute and
I'm not sure. National conservatives aren't going to take over the State Department or the Foreign Office, Alex.
Yeah,
and I think that's the same.
Also, I'm not sure that you can say I think our predictions will be wrong. Why not just make a different prediction in that case?
Yeah, exactly.
But anyhow, no, I do think you know, this. So Will M. Hall has made an ad hominem argument, which I don't think, you know, judge us on what we say. If you think it's contrarianism, I don't particularly think that is on the mark at all. But the anti-left sentiment point, like, I guess, you know, you've got to criticize what's in front of you, really. And yeah, I don't think the, you know, whether we are involved in real form of politics or organizing or whatever, or whether other people are, I think you have to address their arguments on their merits or lack thereof. And, you know, we will make I'll try and make the case for the things that I think are important. I think on this germ point, though, I think this is a Patreon comment, if I remember correctly. Yeah, it is a good challenge, though. I think it's, you know, is it the inchoate state of something which can develop into a kind of a wider conversation or a wider kind of movement for control over foreign policy? I think for similar reasons to Phil, I don't see it happening, but I think it is an important important challenge. Like, why, if you don't think that, why not? And that, yeah, so I think it's probably because it doesn't seem to be even there in a germ form. There isn't a linking to, as a, you know, just repeat my point from earlier, there isn't a, like, we want to take back or take control of the military or foreign policy. Instead, it's a distancing, and it's a kind of attempt to detract or step away from the kind of wider American kind of national project or national kind of military. So that's why I see it as not. I think it's a good question from, I wonder how long you can make a name. We need to have a shorter name for that. But I think in this case, I'll stick with my initial kind of more pessimistic assessment.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole discussion to be had about changing attitudes on foreign policy, American nationalism, as a part of a generational shift in attitudes. But that is a whole other discussion. Moving on to comparisons with populism, situating these protests at the end of history. There's a whole lively debate that happened, which I will try to characterize by picking out two comments from each of the people. But I'd like to highlight it because it's an interesting sort of debate that's happening there, very much on very much Bunga terms, I guess. Anurin says, much like Brexit, a discrete event has provoked some incoherent anti-establishment feeling that would inevitably come to nothing. I don't think it's right to make critical distinctions between these quote-unquote moments. You either think they're the ending of the end of history or that they're all crap. Personally, I think they're all crap, but I understand if you think that they're all worthwhile. You can't pick and choose, though. That is to say, these are all symptomatic of the end of history and kind of breakdown, or it's just dumb bullshit. A distinction which I'm not sure I see, because I think it can be both.
You can, anyway, you can pick and choose. That's politics.
Well, anyway, exactly. So Moldy L responds, there is no horse in the pro-Palestine protests that you could put before or after the cart, and you won't grow one out of a cart. They're precisely trying to make a political program fall out of the sky. It's a rain dance without politics. Regarding Brexit, the difference is between losing a game, that is to say Brexit, you play the game, but you lose, or shouting impotently from the sidelines, campus protest, and I'd rather lose. Just in case that isn't clear, Moldy L is making the point that Brexit was like a real thing, however failed it was, whereas Anurin says, look, all these things are just populist nothings, which we can ignore. Anurin continues in response, comparing the influence of Marxist Brexiteers and Lexiteers to the Farages and Johnsons is nonsensical. I bought the hype at the time too, in regard to Brexit. They're comparable insofar as they represent a break with the status quo. Say what you will about the protests, I can't imagine anything like this happening 20 years ago, no matter what Israel did. Moldy L, then kind of concluding this interchange as you've reconstructed it, says, openings for real political contestation will have to be coughed up from the contradictions within populism and will therefore be tainted in some way or other by populism. That's the tunnel of shit we have to cull through.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, you can't, you know, irrespective of your sympathies over Brexit or the positions that anyone might have taken, it seems to me the two things are vastly different. You're talking about protest movements on elite universities in some Western countries versus a national constitutional question that provoked a political parliamentary crisis that's only comparable to the Home Rule crisis of 1914 or the crisis over the Corn Laws in the middle of the 19th century, and something which also saw, you know, it kind of is complete, well, it's restructured party politics, which is still being felt in the current election with the swing again against the Tories and the failure to hold the red wall. It's stoked up the question of Northern Ireland status within the United Kingdom. It drew in nearly 2 million more voters into the political process. It's still, you know, completely restructuring the direction of British politics in the 21st century. It's simply on an entirely different scale to what's happening over the protests in Palestine, over the pro-Palestine protests on Western campuses. Again, irrespective of where you stand on them or where your sympathies may lie. So I think it's to say those two things, you have to accept them both as symptomatic or reject both of them at the same time. That seems to me a position of extraordinary political cynicism and quiescence ultimately. And I can't accept it as being meaningful.
So I think this is a good discussion between Anurin and Moldy L on Patreon. And one thing you neglected to read out was that Moldy L writes, as an Irish person, I'm predisposed to waving Palestinian flags and hating anything English. So I'm starting to wonder if maybe I've had a stroke. I'm actually defending these degenerate gammon fuckers. And just to say to Moldy L, you know,
gammon fuckers.
No, you know, you're more than welcome to join the degenerate.
Fuck us.
No, not that. To join the degenerate gammons, because that is the, you know, they will take over the world. No, I think it is
really did that. You missed the 19th century, did you?
Oh no! Not, that wasn't gammon. This, you know, gammon is something which only existed in its current form since 2016. But I think there, you know, the point is there. I don't really need to add that much to what Phil said, other than that, you know, Brexit is having this international kind of drawing the Irish working class in, and hopefully we'll see a united Ireland as a consequence in some point in the not too distant future.
Okay, so relatedly, I guess, on the question of the basis of nationhood, so Richard R. has several comments. I've tried to kind of sum them and bring them together. Lots of interesting stuff, but can't do justice to everything. Richard R. says, meh, lackluster analysis. I know Phil has been searching for a way to ground sovereignty that isn't just the already existing structures of the nation state, but so far he's failed. It's about race, the central political problem of Israel and Palestine, the protest movement against Israel, etc. Nation states founded on sovereignty, on blood and or soil. We haven't got a replacement yet that isn't just plain old boring communism. They continue that, you know, and don't get me wrong, I'm making a case about how victimhood is a terrible base for politics. It invites big bad actors to intervene to protect bare life. It justifies unlimited force, etc. But nevertheless, he continues. If Joe Biden is right that Jewish people are not safe without their own nation state, then we are either agreeing that nations and states are bound together by racial or ethnic identity, or else we are saying that Jewish identity is uniquely vulnerable. If nations require states for safety, we are condemning African Americans, indigenous peoples, and many others to permanent statelessness. If Jews alone are uniquely vulnerable, then we basically validate extreme anti-Semitism by virtue of separating Jewishness as an absolutely unique racial or ethnic case. Neither of these options is good. So then that leaves the matter of inventing or else protecting states with complex, multiple relationships to nationality, race, and birth, thus invalidating previous regimes of sovereignty. Otherwise, race realism prevails. You can still have Brexit, if you like it or not, but not without crossing this abyss. Basically, you need ethno-nationalism if you're following through the to the logical conclusion. Richard, separately, I'm just going to bring this in here. I think Eli S. is basically right that Gentiles are working out their neuroses using Israel as a sort of stand-in for a stronger anti-racist program in the U.S. And I would add that there's almost undoubtedly an unconscious attachment to the U.S. empire on the part of many of these protesters, using its power to exert their quote-unquote anti-racist action on Israel. I agree with that. The reason I have gone from reflexive impotence towards the conflict to uncompromising support for Palestinian liberation is that I basically assume that what we're seeing in Gaza right now is a sign of things to come as the U.S. empire slowly fizzles out.
So I'm in an odd position where I agree with some of this very strongly and disagree with some of it very strongly with Richard R's point. I think
that's called dialectics, mate. It's, you know,
thanks.
Sure it is. Yeah,
thanks for that, George. I don't know what's happening. It seems to me is an attempt to shore up, and that's the whatever the pro-Palestine protesters might think they're doing. It seems to me they're effectively shoring up the US's imperial claims in the region, precisely because it's humanitarian rather than framed in different terms, as we've already said. So that doesn't seem to me to that seems to me to speak to prolonging US power outside of US borders rather than drawing the empire in. And I don't think Richard R. would be surprised to say that I don't think Joe Biden is right. And indeed, that it seems that many Jews disagree with Joe Biden. His extraordinary statement that Jews need their own state to be safe was obviously suggesting that American Jews, you know, American Jews can't rely on America. Kind of an extraordinary, I mean, not only kind of an extraordinary statement for the American president to say, but also, I think, telling, right? Because the point is about this idea of vulnerability. And perhaps the American in the kind of the senile fever brain of Joe Biden's declining years, you know, maybe the American kind of imperial state is the one that intervenes from outside to defend all these embattled minorities throughout the world. And so the relationship between the American state and its citizens is no different than that the American state has for human rights victims in some refugee camp on the other side of the world. But Britain isn't a state which is based on an ethnic basis for citizenship. And the classic kind of bourgeois nation state, France, was precisely based on civic claims to citizenship, as indeed was America. So this idea that the only basis for statehood is an ethnic one, I mean, it's simply mistaken. You can obviously criticize plenty of states for falling far short of their egalitarian legal claims in their founding documents and constitutional claims that they make about themselves, but you know, that's ultimately a separate argument. So I don't know, when I'm being accused of finding something to ground sovereignty outside of the existing structure of nation states, sovereignty exists with nation states. And what the claims that I've been trying to make are that we need to build new nations in the context of our existing states. And that is a politically creative process, but one that obviously means politically integrating groups from all sorts of different backgrounds as far as race, ethnicity, religion, and so on goes. And maybe, perhaps I failed so far, but you know, that doesn't mean that it's not the right claim or the right point to be making.
Yeah, very well put. I think it's, you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater if you equate sovereignty with blood and soil. Like, this is an important, well, I mean, I would agree with Phil as one of the co-authors of Taking Control. But yeah, I mean, sovereignty is, I think, a much misunderstood and maligned concept in contemporary political analysis. And it isn't about the basis of the state in ethnicity or anything like that. It is a relationship between the rulers and the ruled. I mean, this goes back to Hobbes, in my understanding, at least. And that is something which, that kind of simultaneous, like, law, ability to make law and also to enforce or to kind of the capacity to rule, that is an important political relationship. And that is, it's a material one, which ultimately, you know, the erosion of all the intermediating institutions means that there is no, you can't go back to these older forms of nations. And so that's why, you know, I don't want to ventriloquize Phil, but that is why it is such an important project to kind of, to look at what are the potential bases of these new nations, because we cannot go back to the old ways of doing things. Anyhow, I said I wouldn't add anything to Phil's point, and
right,
then
so let's move on
to talk. Yeah, we need a more interventionist chair. We need humanitarian intervention on behalf of our listeners.
So continuing on protests and the millennial left and that relationship, which we've kind of hinted at, Patrick Templeton on Instagram commented that maybe you should do another episode on the millennial left, except this time on its future. It's a bit odd to say that we're seeing a retreat of millennials, which is a claim that Phil made, you know, that this was, that millennials are kind of withdrawing over this. This is like the last stand of the millennial left. So Patrick says, I find it odd to say that we're seeing a retreat of millennials right when that generation is beginning to step into the leadership positions in government, the media, workplace, etc. Acquiescence and failure of the left project might be true, but is it really a retreat or a settling in?
I think that's the point, right? It's, insofar as it's a left project, it's a settling in. You see that in the compromises and the retreats of the squad in Congress. But more importantly, I think insofar as it's these group, you know, people moving into leadership positions, it's precisely by abandoning or tempering their radicalism. And it seems to me this is one last hurrah for, especially I think for those who aren't moving into positions of public influence or political leadership, you know, those who are kind of the foot soldiers for Occupy or the readers of Jacobin or, you know, whatever it might be, or the voters for Corbyn. It's those people who I think are essentially retreating at this moment. So
one final comment. Bartleby says, I think Phil and George both missed the mark on their criticisms of the protests and the millennial left more generally. The demands made by the protesters all revolve around divestment. It's an acknowledgement that Americans have no lever to influence the government's never-ending military aid for Israel. It's written in stone, an unalterable law of American politics. But there is a precedent for influencing a body like a university in a sort of proxy battle. The issue for Americans is that this war, and Israel's foreign policy in general, is literally our war. We fund it with our taxes. It would not be possible without ironclad support from the U.S. government. It's not that the students would prefer that Israel don't do nasty things, as Phil put it, Phil puts it. The issue is that we do not want nasty things ourselves. We do not want to do nasty things ourselves with our resources and in our name. If American foreign policy were as directly responsible for the various other disasters that Phil alludes to, there would be protests on those issues as well. But resorting to, what about this humanitarian crisis or that humanitarian crisis? Why don't you care about those things and you only care about Palestine? Only proves that they have no meaning for you, not for them, the protesters. You're using them as cudgels to score points, and incorrectly too. And then as a separate point, as far as to George's prediction, we shall see, but I think the vote for the lesser evil may be way past its expiration date for the left in America, for better or for worse. And then just in a concluding remark, in what way does this this whole discussion have anything to do with the millennial left? Or did you expect the kids on campus to succeed where everyone with actual political power has failed for a century? In other words, there are times to wield political influence to solve intractable problems, and there are times when there's a slaughter happening right now.
Yeah, I should probably address that. So what was my prediction? My prediction was along the lines of...
they'll go back to the Democrats and fall for the lesser evil stuff.
Yeah, and I think given Donald Trump's current legal problems, I think this, I'm more confident, at the risk of sheer fucking hubris, I'm more confident than I was before that this is exactly what will happen. But yeah, as Bartleby says, you know, that's the thing about predictions. You know, you have to to return to your earlier point, Alex, the only thing you have to do is think that they're going to be true and change them if you don't. And I'm not changing that one. I think the risk, so the kind of the note that Bartleby finishes on, there are times to wield political influence to solve intractable problems, and there are times when there is a slaughter happening right now. I guess at the risk of, again, sort of, I don't want to sound callous, but the risk of emphasizing that there is a slaughter happening right now from a political, specifically political perspective, and we made this point before, is that it makes it more attractive to offer a non-democratic solution. It's like, we've got to temporarily, it's like a state of exception. We've got to temporarily suspend the rules because this is too important and people are suffering too much. And that is, you know, that is, it's a hard thing to push against that. But I think that's the argument that we've basically been trying to make. And, you know, I don't know whether the two of you agree with me or not, but that it requires a political analysis. And when you do that, you are going up against very strong moral claims on behalf of humanitarian intervention often or kind of allied or similar things. But yeah, you want to address ultimately the cause, which is the lack of democratic control over foreign policy, not the symptom, you know, however bad that symptom might end up, you know, being at a certain point in time. So, yeah.
I mean, it might surprise you, George, but actually I do agree with you because I do have some considered views about humanitarian intervention.
Well, I'm not sure considered views, but you certainly do have some views.
I think they're fairly considered. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the arguments that critics have made of humanitarian intervention, including myself. And I say that because there aren't actually that many of them who made this point, which is the fact that it's part of the emergency politics of the end of history. The humanitarian framing something as a humanitarian emergency rather than as a understanding it in political terms necessitates immediate action, and that justifies and legitimizes the use of military force without thinking about how military force connects to the actual questions of social structure, political organization, political claims, political rights, all the things that are bound up with when something is understood politically. So
if it is your point, then, you know, you can at least take solace in the fact that that's hegemony when people steal your ideas and don't cite you. So you're exercising micro hegemony within this podcast stealing your ideas.
Perhaps, George, but unfortunately, I'm not a Gramscian, so unfortunately, I can't claim it as a great victory.
You need to back my struggle in resisting Phil's micro hegemony. I'm the victim here, but I'm also the agent of history, but I just need to throw off the Cunliffean yoke.
You cannot be the victim as the editor of the podcast. You have
that is exactly how victimhood works.
That's what I was demonstrating. Anyway, so
let me finish because there was a bit more that I wanted to say about this, because I think what what this listener says here is, I just want to clarify about the other point about drawing attention to other humanitarian crises, right? So, for instance, The Economist is making the case that genocide is happening in Sudan at the moment. And recently, people have been talking about the Tigray War, which hundreds of thousands of people have died. And there's the argument that it's, in fact, has been the most violent conflict in recent times, more than Ukraine, more than Yemen, more than Gaza, and so on. I wasn't claiming whataboutism in drawing attention to these other conflicts. I'm not saying that I would rather see a humanitarian intervention in Sudan than I would in Israel-Palestine. I was only trying to draw attention to what else is motivating the protesters, because, you know, given the fact that it's driven by humanitarian sentiment, there are so many other conflicts that are worse, right, in terms of their lethality and suffering. And so the question is to think about what the politics are, you know, not just to think about what that is, how that's politically significant, and what the background is to all of these conflicts. We've already talked about trying to influence universities, right? The idea that the universities say, I mean, you know, no doubt there are, you know, kind of pension funds that might be invested in military companies, and some universities might have connections to various arms manufacturers, or, you know, involved in supporting or research connected to the military industrial complex. And I'm happy for that. You know, I'm happy for universities not to do that. But the idea that withdrawing universities is going to cause the Israeli military machine, that if universities withdraw their funding, the Israeli military machine is going to collapse, is, I mean, it's, you know, obviously absurd and fantastical. And if the idea is that we should withdraw our connection to Israeli civil society and Israeli academia, that is, like we've already said, not only obnoxious, but also self-defeating. So that aside, you know, I think I'm not sure about this question about whether or not they're going to go back to the Democrats. It seems to me that I think, as we mentioned, I think this will actually damage. I think there will not, you know, perhaps not enough to lose the election, but there will be a measurable impact on the Democratic vote from the left. This is that moment when a certain layer of the left middle class is peeling off from the Democrats in America, it seems to me. But I think also, I think in a way they've already won. Because I think what this marks is, as I've made before, it's a generational shift in elite attitudes towards the Middle East and the replacement of Israel as the ultimate victim identity, the ultimate victim state, with the Palestinians, whose claims to victimhood seem to be increasingly stronger, to displace the claims that and also that it's a victim protectorate. It won't be a victim state, but a victim protectorate, which is even easier to speak on behalf of and to fight for and to claim all sorts of things.
So would you say then that the protests have actually worked?
Well, not in the sense that they would
terms that you just outlined.
Yes, I think they're... They've significant. I mean, as is obvious, right? I mean, you've had three Western states recognize Palestine as an independent state. You've had the ICC targeting Israel. You've had, kind of mid and lower ranking bureaucrats of the State Department come out publicly in opposition to the Biden administration. You've had turmoil within Democratic ranks and on the wider kind of Democratic left. It is a significant moment in the puncturing of Israel's status internationally, and that seems to me a result of the protests and an indication that
I think
they've made their mark, and I think it's a measure of how far sentiment in among the liberal left is turning against Israel. It's been in the works for a long time, and I think this is the moment. The Gaza war is the moment that marks that that shift.
Yeah, I agree with that. So we're going to move on. There's scattered comments on a whole bunch of different episodes, but we're going to take the one that there was a bit more discussion on, which was in response to our discussion of Alex Garland's Civil War. lots of kind of fans of this episode. Brian, Nigel B. Opinion saying it's a fun episode. Brian Gonella saying great episode, way better than the Chapo read of the film. Thank you. Pier Paolo Tamburelli, though, not liking it so much. You could last hear Pier Paolo on our obituary of Silvio Berlusconi. Anyway, so Pier Paolo says, I listened to your Civil War thing and I cannot resist a nasty comment on people who are a bit too focused on texts. The discussion, what's the meaning behind the blowing up of the Lincoln Memorial, is nonsensical. Why should there be a reason behind the glorious visual evidence of blowing up a big iconic neoclassical monument that looks good on screen when on fire? Should there be a meaning? You sound like art historians of the early 80s who were searching for iconographic explanation for every single donkey in a fresco.
Well, the donkey, like Jesus entered Jerusalem riding a donkey on Palm Sunday, guy. I mean, the donkey is important in Christian art, represents kind of humility and service and, you know, ultimately redemption, all of God's creatures.
Yeah, George is right.
He's talking about his ass redeemed. Again, yeah. So, out of his ass, sorry.
No, but look, I mean, you know, there was, I can imagine, it was a choice, right? I can imagine.
So hold your comment a second, because the next one I think is very much to this point, because Sparta FC draws a distinction between conscious and unconscious elements, you know, things that Alex Garland deliberately wanted to do and did, and things which he did, but maybe wasn't aware that he was doing, right? So anyway, they say the contrast between these conscious and unconscious elements and Alex Garland's strengths in this regard was especially clear in the film Men, as noted by Phil. A very unoriginal and tedious conscious message, but very interesting and evocative stuff between the lines. And I think it's true of Civil War too, even if the conscious narrative is slightly stronger than in Men. It's the ambiguities, some of which Garland himself seems oblivious to, which really make Civil War come alive, and when it does so. It's interesting, but perhaps inevitable, that Garland overestimates himself as an intellectual, but seems to underestimate his poetic intuition, which is at its strongest in Annihilation, another film of his, which notably, I believe, he didn't write himself.
Yeah, and it's a good point. I agree with that.
And then Sparta and Mark Larive both point out that the remark about disbanding the FBI, which was Phil thought it was just a sop to kind of liberal prejudice about, you know, that the remark about disbanding the FBI was ambiguous, as was the line about the Antifa massacre. Perhaps the disbanded FBI became part of a regional militia fighting what is left of the federal government, for instance. Yeah, I think these are interesting points that, you know, maybe we can read some of these things contrary to what they present as, you know, and despite Alex Garland's intentions, which is clearly like make an anti-fascist film. But I think, you know, I think as we came to this conclusion, the film's probably more interesting than it lets itself on or than what it actually presents as because of these ambiguities.
I know. I mean, there's also the comment from Moldy L who says the supposed ambiguities in this movie, Antifa Massacre et al., are just Garland's attempts to, this is Moldy L talking, are just Garland's attempts to cover his tracks in what is a very unambiguously liberal hysteria movie in the vein of Paul Lynch's Prophet Song. Or Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. I couldn't help feeling that I was watching these journos wishing events into existence as if the horrors of the world existed only for the glory of some media class aspirant. The heroism of the soldier is replaced by the heroism of the cultured, educated photojournalist whose weapon of choice is the truth, capital T. The movie as a whole is a kind of January 6th for liberals, the first January 6th being a kind of forum theatre piece which here gets rewritten as a Hollywood revenge fantasy against Trump. It reminded me of Eisenstein's October, his storming of the Winter Palace recast with liberal media as the Bolsheviks. The contrast with October is how deliberately anticlimactic it is, because Trump doesn't deserve anything as grand as a storming of his Winter Palace. I can't help feel Garland laments the fact that America won't get someone as massively evil as, say, Hitler, and that the depressing empty feeling the movie leaves me with is the sense that I'll have to be one of the lesser, less cool, less tasteful own brand tyrants like Gaddafi. So I have to say I'm very sympathetic to what Moldy L is saying here, and I agree with what Sparta FC said as well, that the, you know, Annihilation is probably Garland's best movie precisely because it's more intuitive and also probably because, you know, it's he didn't boring. Write it himself.
It's a boring film. This is a
well,
much
because
better
you
film
have no, you have Annihilation. No, you have no real, you have no kind of poetic intuition, George. That's your problem.
I have no poetry in my soul.
No, I don't even know if you have a soul, but, you know, that aside.
I don't
anyway,
have.
I wanted to go back to Pier Paolo's thing, right? Because the choice, you know, it seems to me blowing up the Lincoln Memorial was a choice, right? There was more obvious monuments you could blow up. There would have been more cinematically spectacular, like obviously the Washington Monument, right? So it seems to me there is something of a choice, and it doesn't seem to me like just an arbitrary kind of aesthetic judgment. It seems like there was something else going on there, but you know, who knows? Generally, I agree with what Sparta FC and Muldiel said.
I mean, evidently, I don't have my poetic intuition about my own work, even, because Ben Davis in ArtNet makes the point that Civil War is a film about Brazilianization. It's what Garland is grappling with, and kind of cites kind of the Brazilianization idea in there, which I think is probably true. It's another way in which, I mean, this is not in the text of the film, but might be some of the subtext of a kind of grappling with what kind of the U.S. becoming a kind of messy, fucked up third world country where the president gets arrested and still runs for office, and you have a criminal in office. You know, it's kind of grappling with that sort of idea.
You don't, probably... you've kind of like, you sound like you're going, like you're kind of turning against Brazil, Alex. Where's your Brazilian patriotism?
No, wait, that was never in evidence. It was, you know, it was the contrary. It was, I'm in love with a lost idea, with a lost cause, as we all are. And whether that's the Confederacy, the Palestinians, or the dream of modernity, that's what we're all at a big long wake.
I'm not mourning for the Confederacy,
that,
Alex.
Maybe not you, but you have your own thing that you mourn for, the lost dreams of Brexit or whatever it might
look,
be.
This is a guy with poetry in his soul right here. Look at these things he's saying. I mean, I think the point about like conscious and unconscious, like that, if you edited out some of the bits of Civil War, some of the like most explicitly political bits at the beginning, and maybe a bit at the end, you could make it a better film by removing that kind of heavy-handedness. I think the best bits of the film are just the images and the sounds, and you know, the characters are not that
compelling. I agree with that.
It's like it's a spectacle, and the more, you know, it's a spectacle of American decline, and there's a bit of, you know, a bit of voyeurism in that, and I think when he kind of pulls back from some of the political commentary, those are the best bits of the film, I think.
Indeed. I mean, in fact, you know, the kind of point that Muldiel makes about it being, you know, the US's kind of decline or breakup would be with some like uncool, distasteful tyrant like Gaddafi. I think that kind of undersells Gaddafi. I think Gaddafi's cooler and more interesting than you know, Muldiel.
Is he one of your top three dictators?
He wrote a book, you know, green book, which is interesting. He invited a bunch of models to his palace, friends with Berlusconi. I think there's cool. There's some cooler bits about Gaddafi, much more than like Saddam. He's more interesting than Saddam. Anyway, that's another. We can do an anniversary episode, the coolest dictator. But I think that the point about grappling with, you know, the Brazilianization point is that, you know, Brazil isn't Sudan, right? It's not some absolute terrible decline or some terrible, you know, it's just kind of it's the kind of low level dystopia of a kind of or a low level civil war, which is going on despite no one, you know, remarking on it in the media, because what it is, it's like 60,000 murders a year, which happen, you know, kind of under the radar. And so it's like civil war levels of violence, but without any kind of conscious political expression. So it's not the great big cataclysmic breakdown. It's just this grinding shitness. And I think that is a point which Garland, I think, is able to depict consciously or unconsciously in Civil War, which, I think it kind of fits this idea. I think we've got to finish here. We should wrap up. There was just two more comments, which I'm just going to gesture to very quickly. Apologies for not doing these justice, but on the last Outfit bonus, Mads Vindahl commented about whether the state should provide culture, and that, you know, this could be horribly bureaucratic and whatever, but does cite Mark Fisher's capitalist realism. And I'm going to read this quote because it's worth, you know, having out there. "I have an idealistic view," Mads says, quoting Mark Fisher. "I have an idealistic view, but if the BBC could do that, taking people beyond their own selves, it will renew itself in a way that jumps over the competition. The competition is obsessed by serving people in their little selves. And in a way, actually, Murdoch, for all his power, is trapped by the self. That's his job, to feed the self. In the BBC, it's the next step forward. It doesn't mean we go back to the 1950s and tell people how to dress. What we say is, we can free you from yourselves, and people would love it. I think that's worth dwelling upon. I think is an interesting proposition. Whether existing state broadcasters can fulfill that function is another question. And then just finally, JKJKJK says, agreed with the point that George made on the last Alpha Bonus Bonus that Joe Rogan is indeed a masculine role model. He's in excellent shape, associated with stereotypically masculine MMA crowd, has a reputation as a guy that doesn't really care what self-satisfied liberals think of him when they sneer at him and his fans. He's not an effete liberal, but is a compassionate person. He's funny, and he promoted stuff like MMA, boxing, jiu-jitsu, which are more positive outlets for young men than crime or insuldom. And continues in this vein for a little bit longer, but it's a great reminder that you can be a flawed but normal and cool person who engages in stereotypically masculine attitudes, and the anti-masculine liberals can't really do anything about it. Yeah, this is kind of the dudes rocked or dudes celebrating their win kind of it's kind of accounts that are out there. And yeah, I think that's good. I think that's good.
Being curious and not overly caring what people say about you. I think those are good, good traits if you can get them, if you can get yourself there.
So I don't care what anybody said in their comments about what we said on this podcast.
But please review the podcast and give it 5 stars and just tell your friends how good it is.
Yeah, exactly. What George said. Okay. Thank you, everyone. Thanks, George and Phil. Thank you, everyone, for your comments and questions. And we look forward to doing another one of these. As I say, and I keep promising this, that we're going to do these more regularly, but we are. We're having a meeting in 2 days where we're going to make this commitment that we're going to do these Alpha Bonus Bonus things more often. That way we don't have to do them for so long. We can be a little bit snappier with them. So all that to look forward to, and plenty more coming up this month. I'm quite excited. We're having a whole range of different countries which we're touching on: Mexico, Saudi Arabia, India, Korea. I've missed something else besides Russia. So anyway, I'm very excited about what's coming up in June. You're hearing this already well in the throes of June. I hope you're enjoying it. We will see you next time. Catch you later. Bye-bye.